questions? All right, with the recorders running. All right, page 680, chapter 47, verse 1 is where we'll pick it up. But before we get into chapter 47, let's review the last few moments of chapter 46. The end of chapter 46, Ezekiel was taken to the far west end of the temple, and we got a look at the kitchens for the Zadokite priests. We learned that these kitchens are where the Zadokite priests would prepare their sacrificial meals, their worship meals, and they were specifically commanded to prepare the meals back in these kitchens because they were to keep a distinction between the sacred and the secular. They were not to eat these meals out in the outer court, but keep the meals contained in the area associated with the inner court. All right, from that point on, after looking at the kitchens, Ezekiel now received a tour around the perimeter of the Messianic temple. And as he went around the perimeter, he was shown four other courts, and these courts turned out to be identical in size, and they turned out to be kitchens as well. And these were kitchens for the rest of the Levitical priests who serve in the outer court, and this is where they would cook and eat their worship meals as well. So there's a clear distinction between the regular Levites and the Zadokite Levites. The regular Levites serving in the outer court, the Zadokites serving in the inner court. All right, that brings us now to chapter 47. Top of page 680, point E in your outline. We get a look now at the Millennial River. We begin by looking at the source, the origin for the river in verse 1. So everybody in chapter 47, verse 1, page 680. Okay. Then he brought me back to the door of the house, and behold, water was flowing from under the threshold of the house toward the east, for the house faced east. And the water was flowing down from under, from the right side of the house, from south of the altar. All right, here's Ezekiel. He's probably finishing up in this corner of the temple, and the angel then leads him back into the inner court. Now, he has spent lots of time tramping around the inner court, right? We've seen him go all over the inner court. He never got his feet wet, made no mention of any kind of water there. But now, point two in your outline, parentheses number two, he says, behold. That's an exclamation of surprise. All of a sudden, he sees this stream starting to flow out from the temple itself. It wasn't there before, and he sees it miraculously begin right in front of his eyes. Drop down to parentheses number four at the bottom of the page, and we get a summary of the stages that this stream goes through. First of all, 4a at the bottom of the page. The water will trickle from the south corner of the temple threshold. So in other words, it'll be a very tiny stream. It'll pass the altar on the south side, point B, and then point C, it'll go out the temple compound on the south side of the closed outer eastern gate. So up on our diagram, this is what Ezekiel sees. Behold, water starts to trickle out from the temple, goes under the inner court wall, and goes out of the wall of the outer court. That's what he sees, all of a sudden, right before his eyes. All right, page 681. Now, the angel wants him to get a closer look at this water flow, so he's got to get out of the temple to do so. So in verse 2, we see him exit the temple itself, verse 2. He brought me out by way of the north gate and led me around on the outside to the outer gate by the way of the gate which faces east. And behold, the water was trickling from the south side. All right, on your outline there, point parentheses A, he's going to have to take a detour through the inner and outer north gates in order to get to see where the river exits the temple. And remember, that's because these two gates are closed. This one is permanently closed. That one is closed except on the Sabbath, on Shabbat, and other special occasions. So he can't go through those gates. He has to go through the north gate. And then point two, parentheses C, toward the middle of the page. From the northern outer gate, he's conducted outside the outer wall of the temple to the outer eastern gate. So here's his route. Okay, he's standing here. Now he's gonna step over the tiny little stream. Okay, it's gonna be so small he can step over it. He'll step over it. The angel will lead him out of the northern inner gate, out of the northern outer gate, and then he has to trek around the outside of the temple to get back here. And he observes that the water has now flowed, this little trickle has now flowed out of the outer wall of the temple compound itself. And that's what we pick up in point three in the middle of the page. Again, behold, he's very surprised to see this. This little trickle of water has run out of the temple itself. Now that term A, ran out, you see the word hapax there. That means it's a one-time use in the scripture, so we're not totally positive what it means, but it appears to mean that the water is a very small stream that is just, we would call, a trickle. And point three there, what trickles out in verse 1 and 2 is going to become a river in verses 3 through 5. Okay, make sense? Straightforward? Okay, next page. Page 682. And now Ezekiel is going to describe the growth of this river from a trickle to quite a large stream. And it's going to happen in a number of stages. So the first stage is described in verse 3, chapter 47, verse 3. When the man went out toward the east with a line in his hand, he measured 1,000 cubits, and he led me through the water. Water reaching the ankles. All right, this guy goes eastward, the angel. He has this measuring line. So he measures off 1,000 cubits, as you see on point B, point parentheses B, about a third of a mile. So Ezekiel is here right at the gate of the millennial temple. And so he dutifully follows the angel to the east. Now we'll back up here a little bit and get a full view of the holy domain. So he follows the angel eastward 1,000 cubits, and he comes and stops almost to the edge of the holy domain. He's very close to the edge of the holy domain. It's a half mile from here to here. Okay, remember this is a square mile. So it's a half mile from here to here. He's at the one-third mile mark. And now this little trickle that he could step over is up to his ankles. He now has to wade across the stream. It's now ankle deep, and he has to get wet. All right. Now, the second stage, point B in the middle of your outline, the first part of verse 4, verse 4a. Again, he measured 1,000 and led me through the water, water reaching the knees. So now he goes another 1,000 cubits to the east, out of the gate there, and about two-thirds of a mile from the starting point from the temple. And the water now is knee-deep. He's well outside the holy domain, and now he's got water up to his knees. Okay, all makes sense? The third stage is in the second part of verse 4. Again, he measured 1,000 and led me through the water, water reaching the loins. So again, the angel heads off to the east, and Ezekiel dutifully follows, and he goes another 1,000 cubits, so he's almost a mile away from the temple now. As you see, point two at the very bottom of the page, he's approximately 5,250 feet away from the temple, almost a mile, and the waters are now waist deep. He's up to his waist in water, but he can still wade through the stream. As he wades through it from one side to the other, it's still something he can handle. All right, page 683, top of the page. We now come to the fourth stage of the growth of the river, verse 5. Verse 5. Again he measured 1,000, and it was a river I could not ford, for the water had risen, enough water to swim in, a river that could not be forded. So now he goes another 1,000 cubits eastward, and he's approximately 1.3 miles away from the temple, and he's up to his neck in the water. He has to swim. Now, maybe he didn't know how to swim. Maybe he just, I can't go any further. Things were just getting too deep. It's up to my nose, Lord, angel. You know, he's wet. So this little trickle has miraculously risen to become an impressive river here. What started out as a trickle is now quite deep. Now, this river is miraculous in more way than one. And as we start with point 3 in the middle of page 683, we get a look at its productive abilities. And all you ladies with who have a red thumbs, you're going to enjoy this. Those ladies with green thumbs, you won't worry so much about this. But those of you with red thumbs will like this, okay? All right, verse 6, chapter 47, verse 6. The angel asks him a rhetorical question, verse 6. He said to me, "Son of man, have you seen this?" And then he brought me back to the bank of the river. I don't know if the angel's out there in the river with him or not, but he's up to his neck in the river, and he says, "You know, have you ever seen anything like this?" Of course, the answer is no. I've never experienced anything like this. And so they slog back to the river. Doesn't say whether the angel gave him a towel or a hair dryer or anything like that. Maybe he just dried off miraculously. I don't know. But he's back at the edge of the river now. And there's a reason why the angel brought him back to the edge of the river, to the bank of the river. One, to probably keep him from drowning. But point 2, at the bottom of the page there, he's going to get a view of the extraordinary fertility of the river. So he trudges on back, trudges out of the river, all like a soaked cat here. And page 684, he gets a surprise in verse 7. Page 684, page 7. He now notices some trees by the river, verse 7. "Now, when I had returned, behold, on the bank of the river there were very many trees on one side and on the other." So he finally gets out from the middle of the river, and he utters an exclamation of surprise. Point B, behold. You know, he is astounded, he's awestruck, he's startled. Why? Because he's been trekking up that river for 1.3 miles and he hasn't seen any trees. He's been walking along that river in and out of it. Ain't no trees around. But now he gets out of the river and boom, all of a sudden these trees are sprouting up on both sides of the river. Miraculously. Point C. Obviously, they were not there when Ezekiel began his 4,000-cubit trek, but they are now. And that emphasizes the miraculous life-giving productivity of the river. So this is not just water. This is super water. Okay, it's got a lot of plant food in it. So you ladies with a red thumb, you know, just one drop in your rose bush, boosh, perfect roses instantly, okay? They could be olive trees. It doesn't say what kind of trees these are. Huh? They could be olive trees. We'll learn more about these trees in a few minutes here. Okay? So this is a miraculous river in more ways than one, not only in its origin and growth, but in its power. By the way, it's probably better tasting than anything you can get from Arrowhead, and free. You don't even have to get it bottled, right? Okay. Well, let's take a look then at the course of the river and its effects. Middle of page 684, point B. A river has to flow its course. What will be the course of this particular river? We begin in verse 8. Then he said to me, These waters go out toward the eastern region and go down into the Arabah. Then they go toward the sea, being made to flow into the sea, and the waters of the sea become fresh. All right, let's start with right parentheses number one there, Roman numeral number one, toward the middle of the page. The river starts to flow eastward out of the temple compound, and then it's going to turn south. So now let's back up and see the entire millennial Mount Zion. Here we see the river coming out eastward from the temple. We don't know how far eastward it goes, at least a mile and a third. It may go, you know, quite a bit farther, but eventually it turns south. And it's going to, we're going to learn that it's going to flow down to Jerusalem. All right, let's turn to page 685. We know that it turns south because at the top of page 685, point B, we're told that it's going to go down to the Arabah. The Arabah is the Jordan River Valley, where the Dead Sea is. And so that's the sea in Roman numeral B1 there. It shall go to the sea, that'll be the Dead Sea. But the language of the Hebrew points out to us that there's actually two seas mentioned and two rivers. Notice point two. Into the sea shall the waters go. That's a reference to the Mediterranean Sea. So the reference here is toward the Dead Sea and the Arabah and the Mediterranean Sea. And we know there are the two rivers there because of the on a number of lines of evidence that we'll look at here. The first line of evidence is point three there, grammar. The word, you see the Hebrew word there for issue forth. In sound, that is a dual form. Grammatically, you know, Hebrew is a very flexible language. For those of you who have taken it, you know that it can be maddening. Grammatically, it's not a perfect dual form, but in sound, it is a dual form. And the dual form, for example, you have two of them. It's in the plural. Word is eyes point two interpreted the phrase to mean that the river would divide into two separate rivers, one flowing to the Dead Sea, and as you see in your outline, one flowing to the Mediterranean. Now I think that was a pretty good analysis of what's happening here, and other data will inform and support this position. Point B. Right parentheses B, Zechariah 14:8. What does Zechariah 14:8 say? Zechariah states, in that day is the day of the Messianic Kingdom, in that day, living waters, and in a biblical sense and in a Jewish sense, living water means flowing water, not stagnant water. In that day, living waters will flow out of Jerusalem, half of them toward the Eastern Sea, and the other half toward the Western Sea. And it will be in summer as well as in winter. So here we learn from this section of Scripture, there are going to be two rivers associated with Jerusalem flowing in opposite directions, and they will never, they will not be dry wadis, they will not be wadis which dry out in the summer, but in the summer and winter there'll be water flowing. Okay, how do you account for that? Well, we can account for it by bringing in the data here from Ezekiel. All right, now, Joel 3:18 also informs our interpretation here. Point C in your outline, Joel 3:18. What does Joel see? In that day is the Messianic Kingdom, in that day the mountains will drip with sweet wine and the hills will flow with milk, and all the brooks of Judah will flow with water. And there's a poetic description of the great productivity that will not only be in Israel, but throughout the world during the Messianic Kingdom. But notice what he says at the end of the verse. And a spring will go out from the house of the Lord to water the valley of Shittim. All right, let's look at your outline. Point one. A fountain or a spring will come forth from the house of Jehovah. It's exactly what Ezekiel has said, right? Joel is seeing the same river. And it shall water the valley of Shittim. The valley of Shittim is the lower region of the brook Kidron, the Kidron Valley. Now, we're very used to looking at the Kidron Valley on the eastern side of Jerusalem, of the old city. You know, Jesus will, the Garden of Gethsemane was there in the Kidron Valley, etc. Very familiar with it. But that's only a tiny, tiny portion of the Kidron. The Kidron Valley continues to the south and then turns to the east and ends up down at the Jordan River, down at the in the Arabah. And that lower portion of the Kidron Valley is called the Valley of Shittim. Okay? So we have the same data that Ezekiel told us. We have water coming out from the temple, going down to the Arabah, and watering the area of the Dead Sea. So again, Joel's data supports Ezekiel. And we've got to integrate Zechariah's data in there. And we can add one more little bit of information. Add to the bottom of the page there, write parentheses D, write it in. It isn't in there for yourself, I'm adding this. Write parentheses D. Another bit of data that informs our interpretation here is Isaiah 33, verses 20 and 21. So write that in, Isaiah 33, verses 20 and 21. Now what does Isaiah contribute to this? Okay, Isaiah writes, "Look upon Zion, the city of our appointed feasts. Your eyes will see Jerusalem." So here, Zion and Jerusalem, they are the same city. These are synonymous terms. "Your eyes will see Jerusalem, an undisturbed habitation." And here's a poetic description of Jerusalem in the kingdom. "A tent which will not be folded, its stakes will never be pulled up, nor any of its cords torn apart. But there the majestic one, the Lord, will be for us." Let me start right there, stop right there. So we learn here that Jerusalem will experience security and permanence during the 1,000 years of the Messianic kingdom. It will not be like a tent. You know, when we go camping, we take our tent, we unfold it, we stick it up, we get done, the weekend's over, we tear the tent down, we take the tent cords away. Well, that's a picture of Jerusalem being destroyed. You know, growing up and being destroyed, going up and being destroyed, that won't happen again. Jerusalem will experience security throughout the 1,000 years of the Messianic kingdom. All right, but more information. "But there the majestic one, the Lord, will be for us a place of rivers and wide canals, on which no boat with oars," and that's in the Hebrew, that's a reference to a war vessel, "no boat with oars will go, and on which no mighty ship," and that again refers to ships of war, "will pass." So Ezekiel lets us know that in Jerusalem there's going to be rivers and wide canals during the Messianic kingdom. Are any rivers and wide canals in Jerusalem today? You guys that have been there, do you see any? You didn't see any. You didn't take any boat rides. Things are going to be different in the Messianic kingdom. And here's a diagram out of Dr. Fruchtenbaum's Footsteps of the Messiah that kind of summarizes this for us. And I know that you'd break my arm if I didn't give it to you. So I have it for you. And we see on this diagram, we have the 1 square mile temple, the Millennial River flowing to the east and turning south and coming into Jerusalem, breaking into a number of streams and rivers flowing throughout Jerusalem, and then 2 major branches going to the east, down to the Dead Sea, and to the west, going down to the Mediterranean Sea. So this is kind of a more detailed diagram of what it appears that Millennial Jerusalem will be like. Let me hand this out to you. You can stick this into your notebook right here. Included Isaiah 33 passage at the top, just because I had some extra space there, and I like that Isaiah 33 passage. I did it again, Lester. I did it again. You get to sit over here. I'll get it to you. Yeah, we've got some extras here. There's going to be plenty. There we go. All right, extras. Everybody get one here? Tanya, okay. Extras here. Everybody got one? All righty. Now, if you've got Footsteps of the Messiah, you've got this diagram already in the book on page 471. If you don't have Footsteps of the Messiah, you have it for yourself. Now, on page 690 of your notes, you also have a very basic diagram of the Millennial River as well. So I think this was a better one, so that's why I reproduced it for you. Maybe you want to put it in after page 690 or before page 690. That might be a good place for it. Yeah, there will be great topographical changes.
So saying the frame of reference that we would have with regards to where these positions are today would not be accurate.
Yeah, whenever I drop them onto a map, that's just that's not going to be the same.
No.
Things will look a little different, yeah.
Quite different.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, things.
What about the Suez Canal? If topographically that isn't necessary, then...
Well, that's the point. Remember, we learned that... that when Israel returns, the area there of the Gulf of Suez will be dried up. Remember we learned that? That there's not going to be a Gulf of Suez at the end of the tribulation period.
In regards to the prophet, when he walks and gets inundated in the water, there is no baptismal reference to that, is there?
I don't think so, no. Because he doesn't go all the way under. He just goes up to his nose, maybe. Yeah, the angel rescues him, yeah. All righty, that clear for everybody?
The Dead Sea was no longer dead,
right? We'll take a look at the Dead Sea in just a few minutes here. Well, wait a second now, there's more details to come. Okay, we'll get to the Dead Sea in just a few minutes here, and you'll get more details on the Dead Sea. All right, now that's page 686. At the top of the page, the result, the waters will be healed. The waters of the Dead Sea will become fresh. But there's more details to come. There's more details to come because in verses 9 through 11, we look up in detail upon the effects of life in the Dead Sea when the water comes to the Dead Sea, when the super water gets down there. So we pick that up in verse 9. Verse 9. It will come about that every living creature which swarms in every place where the river goes will live. So this river is going to have a lot of life in it, super water. And there will be very many fish, for these waters go there and the others become fresh. So everything will live where the river goes. All right, let's take a look at the effect on the life in the Dead Sea. Point right parentheses A, every place where the rivers come. Now, the NASB made that word rivers singular. But the Hebrew is a dual form again. So there's two rivers involved here. Again, one heading down to the Mediterranean and one going down to the Dead Sea, splitting there at Jerusalem. And the result is a great multitude of fish. Point Roman numeral 2 there. Great swarming fish life in this river. So the Dead Sea and this river are going to be filled with fish, something that does not happen today, right? Something that is not true of the Dead Sea today. But this is not the whole story. We'll get some more of the story on page 687 and verse 10. And I don't think we'll get through, we'll get through verse 10 and we'll take our break after verse 10. At the top of the page, the effects upon the fishing industry, verse 10. And it will come about that the fishermen will stand beside it. From Ein Gedi to Ein Engleim, there will be a place for the spreading of nets. Their fish will be according to their kinds, like the fish of the great sea, very many. All right, so we have two fishing areas noted on our map. Now, the best we can do, Roger, you're right, is plop Millennial Mount Zion on a modern map. Things are going to be different in the kingdom. The Dead Sea will be identifiable. Well, we see here it's got to change its shape because Millennial Mount Zion may intrude upon the northern part of it. Now, first place mentioned is Ein Gedi, point A, in the center of the western shore. That's Ein Gedi. And then Ein Engleim. Ein Engleim, by the way, happens to fit right there. That's where Ein Feshka, or Ein Engleim, is today. And I was quite amazed when I put this all together that it actually fit my map. Everything worked. I couldn't believe it. Okay. So apparently, from this location to this location, this northern part of the Dead Sea will be swarming with fish. It's a place for the spreading of nets. Now, point C2 says this is impossible in the present Dead Sea. That's an overstatement. That's an overstatement. There is life in the Dead Sea. It's very rare. And you have to go to the right locations to find it. But I'll show it to you here. If you want to find life in the Dead Sea, you got to go to the hotels. Okay? And you'll find life in the Dead Sea, all right? Any of you know Ruth? No, you don't know her. Okay. Well, no sweat. She's the gal that leads the Sarel trips over to Israel. You like that joke, huh? Okay. All right, so there are tourists in the Dead Sea today, and they're rare, but you can find them in the right locations. Now, this fish is described, point three, after their kinds, like the fish of the Mediterranean Sea. So point 3a tells us that there's going to be similar varieties of tropical fish, just like in the Mediterranean. And so the Dead Sea is going to be swarming with all kinds of tropical fish. Great, great abundance of fish. So I thought this was a nice picture to illustrate that the Dead Sea will be very different in the kingdom than it is today. But again, this is not the whole story. We'll pick up the rest of the story in verse 11 after your break. Okay, take your break, listen for the shofar, and we'll pick it up afterwards. All right, we're underway again. All right, let's pick up more information about the Dead Sea. We know that the northern half of the Dead Sea is going to have tremendous, tremendous varieties of fish in it. But what about the south part of the Dead Sea? In verse 11, we learned about the land of salt. Verse 11, chapter 47, verse 11. But its swamps, speaking of the Dead Sea here, but its swamps and marshes will not become fresh. They will be left for salt. So this appears that the south end of the Dead Sea will not be healed. So here we have our map. Here, the northern end of the Dead Sea healed, swarming with fish, but now the southern end of the Dead Sea left for salt. So the healing effects of the river will not extend all the way down here. It'll only be prominent right up in the northern end of the Dead Sea. All right, turn to page 688. Yeah, it's a miracle in itself, too. Now, page 688, we dig into the Hebrew a little bit more. You see at the top of the page the phrase, it shall be given to salt. Now, that phrase can be rendered two ways in the Hebrew, being a flexible language. Number one, A, it can be rendered given up to salt. Now, if that is what's meant, that means the phrase is a sign of judgment, point Roman numeral 1. And there's four examples of salt being a sign of judgment in your outline. Let's take a look at Psalm 107, verse 34. He changes rivers into a wilderness and springs of water into a thirsty ground, a fruitful land into a salt waste. So here God is quite able to turn what is fruitful into what is barren. Why does he do it? And of course, this is the symbol of judgment here. He does it because of the wickedness of those who dwell in it. So turning something into salt can be a sign of judgment. So again, this area will be perpetually desolate and it will remain pretty much the same as it is today. And it may be because of its close proximity to Edom. See, Edom is right here. The boundary of Edom is right here. And we know that Edom will be a desolate, burning wasteland during the 1,000 years of the Messianic Kingdom. So the fact that the southern end of the Dead Sea is close to Edom might be one of the reasons why it's given over to salt. We'll have to see when we get there. All right, that's the first way you could render that phrase. Roman numeral 3 in the middle of the middle of the page. You get the second way you could render that phrase. It shall be given for salt. Now, if that is the correct rendering, This speaks of a provision of salt, of a mineral provision there in the south, at the south end of the Dead Sea. And so it's possible that the southern end of the Dead Sea would provide mineral resources for Israel during the kingdom, as it does today. Here's a satellite view of the southern end of the Dead Sea. And you see the Dead Sea has retreated quite a bit. It's quite a bit lower today than it has been in a good number of years. But you see these are all evaporation ponds created by the Dead Sea works. And the water is pumped into the evaporation ponds, the water evaporates, and a tremendous amount of mineral wealth is pulled out of the Dead Sea even today.
That would make sense because in the millennium paradigm, you wouldn't have any frame of reference relative to the new creation that would be relative to a curse.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So it wouldn't be cursed, it would be useful and edifying.
And maybe both senses are meant. Maybe both senses are meant. It's possible that the curse on Edom, because Edom is going to be a burning wasteland where the demons are confined. Edom will be a burning wasteland of pitch where demons are confined. And that the very fact of proximity to judgment can also provide blessing. And of course, God can always do that. He can always turn judgment into blessing, and that may be the idea here. I don't know.
The Dead Sea,
yeah. Well, the Hebrew name is the Salt Sea, so it's, as far as I know, it's the same name. Well, biblically, it's the Salt Sea, yeah, but we all know it commonly as the Dead Sea, so same place. All right, so we don't know exactly the way we should render that phrase. Maybe it speaks of judgment, maybe it speaks of blessing, maybe it's both. We'll see in the kingdom, but there very well could be mineral wealth provided for Israel. All right, page 689. Now we get a look at the super water again. And again, all you ladies with the red thumbs, you'll appreciate this. Here I've got some super water for you. Small bottle, you know, cheap. One drop on your plant, you're in good shape. Verse 12. By the river on its bank, on one side and on the other, will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither and their fruit will not fail. They will bear every month because their water flows from the sanctuary, and their fruit will be food and their leaves for healing. So again, he's given a look at this river, and we see that on both sides of the river, we have a great number of trees growing along this river. And you'll notice, starting in double parentheses B there, they're fruit trees. They're always green, always productive. In fact, point 3A, they give a new crop every month. And the reason why these trees are so productive is because of the source of the water, super water from the temple itself. And then point C at the bottom of the page, the usage of the trees. They'll be for food. The fruit shall be for food. They'll be eaten. And they'll be used for healing. The leaves will have curative powers. Not only will the fruit be very useful, but the leaves themselves. Most trees these days don't have useful leaves. You just rake them up and burn them up. Yeah.
So there will be disease at that time?
Well, in the Messianic Kingdom, there will be a small measure of sin. There will be a small measure of death. We've seen that. So it's possible there could be a measure of disease as well. But we won't. But we'll have a worldwide medical program overseen by the Messiah. He'll just make sure you get a leaf here from one of these trees. Yes.
This is a different river from the Revelation.
Just a second now. I'll get to that in just half a second. Okay, so these leaves then will be like aloe vera, right? You know, aloe vera is in everything these days. It's the first thing I thought of. Yeah, aloe vera in your hair, your shampoo, and in your perfume, and in your this and that, in your skin lotion. Okay, well, it's an example of how these leaves will have healing properties. Now, like your question here, don't confuse this verse with Revelation 22, 1 and 2. Don't get the two confused. Now look at what Revelation 22, 1 and 2 says. Then he showed me a river of the water of life, clear as crystal, coming from the throne of God and of the Lamb, in the middle of the street. On either side of the river was the tree of life, bearing 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. Sounds very similar, doesn't it? The problem is this description happens in the eternal order. This is the New Jerusalem that comes down out of heaven, 1,500 miles square. The river is coming out of the out of that city. And it's very similar description to what we have here, but it's a different time era, different dispensation. This is the eternal order. Probably, just like there's 12 foundations of the city, 12 tribes probably connect with the 12 tribes. We'll leave it there, yeah. Okay, so don't confuse the two. Remember, this is a different time frame. As you read the book of Revelation, you see in chapter 22, we're well into the eternal order here. And we're in the Messianic kingdom in Ezekiel. We don't go into the eternal order in Ezekiel. All righty, page 690, you have your diagram that you can refer to. Now, page 691. Now we come to a description of millennial Israel itself. We're going to expand our view beyond millennial Mount Zion and take a look at the entire promised land. Now you'll see point F1 at the top of the page, that millennial Israel will be a fulfillment of the covenant. It'll be a fulfillment of the land covenant. We'll talk about that in just a moment. We begin by looking at the division according to tribes in verse 13, point A. The land will be divided up according to the tribes. Verse 13. Thus says the Lord God, this shall be the boundary by which you shall divide the land for an inheritance among the 12 tribes of Israel. Joseph shall have two portions. So parentheses B. The land will be divided once again according to tribal divisions. But it's very specifically stated that Joseph will have two portions, point two. Now, those two portions are the blessing of the firstborn. The firstborn was preeminent in the family, and he received a double blessing of the inheritance. So if you had 12 tribes, you'd divide the inheritance into 13 divisions, and you'd give two of them to the firstborn. So here, the two portions are going to go to Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, what's the background to this fact that Joseph will have two portions? Well, the background is point B in the middle of the page. It deals with the fact that Reuben lost his birthright. Now, who is Reuben? Reuben was Jacob's firstborn. And so normally we'd expect Reuben to get the double blessing of two portions. But Reuben lost his birthright. How did this happen? Well, let's take a look at points A and B, Genesis 35 and Genesis 49. How did it happen? Genesis 35 tells us this, Genesis 35, 22. It came about while Israel was dwelling in the land that Reuben, his firstborn, that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. All right, a concubine is a secondary wife. So Reuben is committing adultery with one of his father's wives here. And it doesn't remain secret. And Israel heard of it. Dad hears about the fact that his son committed adultery with one of his wives. Didn't sit well with him or with God. Now, when we get to chapter 49 and the blessings that are to come upon the tribes, what does Reuben experience? Jacob speaks to Reuben with the first blessing, and this is what he says. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. Sounds like the description of the firstborn, right? Boy, this guy is set up to have blessing. But now Jacob mentions Reuben's flaw. Reuben is morally undisciplined, uncontrolled as water. There it is. Reuben, you are like a stream of water. You have no moral discipline. And now he describes it. You shall not have preeminence. And so the preeminence of Reuben is taken away from him. Why? Because you went up to your father's bed and then you defiled it. There it is. Genesis, the event that happened way back in Genesis 35 comes to the fore. And Reuben loses his birthright. And notice what Jacob says next. You can just hear the humiliation in his voice. And imagine the scene. He's on his bed. He's dying. He's got his 12 sons gathered around him. He's going to pronounce the blessing on them as he's about to die. So notice the scene here in your mind. He says, you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. And then he looks to the rest of his sons. He went up on my couch. Can you just hear him say it that way? You defiled it. He went up on my couch. So everybody knows exactly why Reuben lost his birthright. Keep this in mind. 30 minutes of pleasure, 30 minutes of sin, cost Reuben an eternity of blessing. 30 minutes of sin, and there is pleasure in sin for a season, cost Reuben an eternity of blessing. Well, let's go on to point two. Genesis 48. In Genesis 48, we learn that Jacob made a promise to Joseph. Genesis 48, 5 and 6. He says to Joseph, now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine as Reuben and Simeon are. He's telling Joseph that these two children will not be considered grandchildren. They will be considered first generation children. Just like Reuben and Simeon are my first generation children, the children of my body, they will be considered my children, not my grandchildren. He's elevating their status. But your offspring that have been born to them shall be yours. They shall be called by the names of their brothers in their inheritance. The rest will be grandsons. But Ephraim and Manasseh are elevated to the point of being heirs, direct heirs of Jacob.
How does he assume that?
Because he's the patriarch.
Yeah,
that's his business, yeah. Genesis 49. Now the blessing goes to Joseph. He gets to, Genesis, 48:22. He continues. I give you, speaking to Joseph, I give you one portion more than your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow. Now we learn that the promise made to Joseph is that he is going to receive the double blessing. Now we get to the double blessing in Genesis 49. When he gets around to Joseph, this is what he says. Joseph is a fruitful bough. A fruitful bough by a spring. Its branches run over a wall. So Joseph is highly regarded here. He has brought great benefit to the family, even though he's suffered a lot. He's a fruitful bough. Now his suffering at the hands of his brothers is poetically described. The archers bitterly attacked him and shot him and harassed him. How did Joseph react to that? But his bow remained firm. His arms were agile. So Joseph took the persecution. He remained faithful to the family. He remained faithful to his God. From the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel, from the God of your father who helps you, and by the Almighty who blesses you with blessings of heaven above. So there's the source of the blessing. It's going to be God himself. He now lays the blessings upon him. He will receive blessings from the deep that lies beneath, and blessings from the breasts and the womb. The blessings of your family, of your father, have surpassed the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of the one distinguished among his brothers. So a tremendous blessing is now placed on the head of Joseph. He takes the place of preeminence in the family, surpassing Reuben. And we learn finally at the bottom of the page in 1 Chronicles 5:1 that it was Reuben's birthright that he received. 1 Chronicles 5:1. Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, so that he is not enrolled in the genealogy according to his birthright. So Reuben is not enrolled as the firstborn. He has been diminished. And so Joseph received his birthright plus Reuben's. One portion went to Ephraim, one to Manasseh. And remember, 1 hour of pleasure cost him an eternity of blessing. And that is something we need to remind ourselves of as well, right? Because there is pleasure in sin for a season. And what would that pleasures be? Could be sexual pleasure like Reuben here, or like any man and woman. It could be other pleasures, other lusts, other things this world offers. And they may offer you more pleasure than 30 minutes or 60 minutes or a day or a week or a month. You might get these pleasures for a few years. Who knows? But if you go chasing after sin, remember, there's only pleasure in sin for a season, and it will cost you an eternity of blessing. You will lose out on your eternal rewards. You will be saved. I'm not saying anyone's going to lose their salvation here, right? But at the judgment seat of the Messiah, we will lose out on our rewards. We will lose an eternity of blessing. Make sense? Okay. All righty. Page 692. Now we're going to look at the covenant base for this blessing for the land. And that comes out in verse 14. Speaking of the land now, you shall divide it for an inheritance, each one equally with the other, for I swore to give it to your forefathers, and this land shall fall to you as an inheritance. So we learn in the kingdom arrangement, point 1b there, parentheses b, that every tribe will receive an equal portion, point b and c. He's probably speaking in square miles, the same square mileage for each. This is in contrast to the Mosaic system, point D, parentheses D, where every tribe received a portion according to the size of the tribe. Here's the Mosaic division of the land. And you know, notice Benjamin, small tribe, small area. Judah, large tribe, large area. Look at Manasseh, area on either side of the Jordan River. So a larger tribe, you got larger area. But in the kingdom, apparently the same square mileage, no matter the size of the tribe. Now notice point two. I swore to give to your fathers, literally in the Hebrew, I lifted up my hands. A solemn, solemn oath. This is emphasizes the solemnity of the oath. Now, what is in view here? The covenants are in view here. And the two covenants that are in view are the Abrahamic covenant and the land or Palestinian covenant. I prefer to call it the land covenant, but Dr. Fruchtenbaum has it on the outline as the Palestinian covenant because most commentaries and other literature call it the Palestinian covenant. I think that's a poor name for it. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to review the Abrahamic covenant with you. Why? Because this is incredibly foundational material that you all need to know. I remember you, buddy. Right there's yours. This is foundational material that you need to master. Now, if you've gone through this material before, if you've been with me, we've gone through this material at least a billion times, but there's nothing wrong with reviewing it. And those for which this material is new, this is for you. And we will give you a quick overview of the Abrahamic and land covenants. And you can study these in details by looking at the verses that are on the chart. But this is foundational material. Okay, any extras there? All righty, got an extra. I know we have enough. We'll get some more back here. Okay, got them. Everybody in the back got one? Yeah, anyone need an extra? Everybody have one? You've got enough? Okay. All righty. I'll build this chart, these three slides for you quickly, just to orient ourselves to the covenants that are being fulfilled here. All right, we start with the Abrahamic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant was made with Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, repeated in Genesis 13, 15, and 17. The Abrahamic covenant was then passed on to Isaac, confirmed to Isaac, not Abraham's other son, Ishmael, Genesis 26. Confirmed to Jacob, not Isaac's other son, Esau, in Genesis 28. Then confirmed to all 12 tribes in Genesis 49 with the blessings of Genesis 49. Now, the Abrahamic covenant is made up of three basic overriding promises. Each promise is twofold. The first promise is the land promise, the land of Israel. God says, I will give the land to you and to your descendants. That's one of the reasons why I'm expecting to have my little plot. It's not only given to Abraham, but to his descendants as well. The next promise is the national promise. Again, twofold. First part of the promise, national election. Your family is the chosen people. And this family will have a unique relationship with the Gentile nations. That relationship is brought out in Genesis 12:3. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. Something that is not said of any other nation in the world. Not said of China, not said of the USA, not said of Great Britain, not said of India, only said of the Jewish people. The third promise is the spiritual blessing promise. God says, I will bless you, and you will bless others. So if you read the verses in the left-hand column, you will see all these factors brought out. Now, another factor that you need to know about is the fact that the Abrahamic covenant is eternal. It is in effect today and will be in effect through the eternal order. And it is unconditional. By unconditional, that means that God will see to its fulfillment. It doesn't depend on the Jewish people. This covenant will be fulfilled no matter what Abraham and his descendants do. God has committed himself to the fulfillment of this covenant. All right, now the Abrahamic covenant, this is your third slide, back of the back page there on the other side. The Abrahamic covenant and its three promises are expanded. Each promise is expanded and developed by three other eternal and unconditional covenants in the scriptures. The land promise is expanded and developed by the land covenant of Deuteronomy 29 and 30. The national promise is expanded and developed by the Davidic covenant. And I've given you some verses there to look at. The spiritual blessing promise is expanded and developed in the new covenant of Jeremiah 31 and Ezekiel 36. So that's an overview of the Abrahamic covenant. This is the covenant that we're concerned with right here. The land covenant which expands the land promise of the Abrahamic covenant. This covenant needs to be fulfilled, and it's going to be fulfilled when the Jewish people inherit and occupy all of the promised land. Now, point two, middle of the page, the borders of the land. Here we get into the sticky stuff. There's a lot of controversy surrounding the next five, six verses. And the main reason lies in the fact that the locations talked about here are not readily discernible. We don't really know where they are. For example, this is the comments you'll find in the Expositor's Bible Commentary. This comment was written by Dr. Ralph Alexander. He was one of my profs in seminary. Good man, conservative Bible scholar, honest man. Notice the wording he uses. Key words. Speaking of the boundaries, he says, the boundary started at the north, and each side was described in order clockwise. The north border, verses 15 through 17, compare Numbers 34, started at an unspecified point. So we really don't know where it started. Some point on the Mediterranean Sea, on the seacoast there. Though the remainder of the description would imply that the point might be around the mouth of the present-day Litani River on Lebo Hamat. Can see note in verse 15. So we've got a location that we're not really sure of where the border begins. Okay? He continues. This border follows an easterly direction in between the unknown boundaries of Damascus on the south and Hamat on the north. So we've got some unknown boundaries here. To the site of Hazar Enan, the sites of Berothah, Sibraim, and Hazer HaTikon have not been located. We don't even know where these places are. Hamat and Zedad, perhaps, we don't know, but it might be, perhaps modern Sadad, southwest of Homs, as well as the area of Hauran, have each received at least tentative identification. We're really not sure, but tentatively we might make it there. And so, the best I can do, the general scope of this border will be seen in figure 5. So he just gives us a general scope. We can't be too precise. Now, this is a Gentile commentator, a good man. The Jewish commentators feel the same way. This is the Art Scroll Tanakh commentary on Ezekiel. Look at what the rabbi says. There is a vast literature which attempts to identify the place names used in the various passages of Scripture which describe the boundaries of the land. Vast literature. You get 10 rabbis, you get 11 opinions, right? Okay, you better believe it's vast. It would lie outside the scope of our commentary to attempt an accurate description of the boundaries. So we will limit ourselves to a general description of the outline. I will try to be more precise than this. Okay? All right. Now, there are three views. Three views. The first view I call the conventional view. And the conventional view has a heavy dependence on Ezekiel 47, the chapter in front of us. What does the conventional view look like? Well, this is the conventional view in the Expositor's Bible Commentary. This is Dr. Alexander's reference here. That's the way the land, the promised land would look in the Messianic Kingdom. Conventional view. Here's the Macmillan Bible Atlas. Same basic arrangement. Here is the Moody Bible Atlas. Again, very similar, right? And the Bible Knowledge Commentary has this map for the Millennial Kingdom outline. Again, similar. And the English Standard Version Study Bible, they take the conventional view. And finally, Biblica Bible Atlas. These are the atlases I have. And I scanned in their maps for you, so this is the conventional view. Most commentaries and atlases will take this view. There's more to the story. There's another view that I call the minimalist view. And those who hold to the minimalist view have a heavy dependence on Numbers 34. Now here's the English Study Bible, and they recognize that there's another view. And they recognize it right up here in this note. This red line are the boundaries of the promised land as described in Numbers 34. The green is the boundaries of the promised land described in Ezekiel, but they notice the other view. And here is the other view, the minimalist view. So those who focus on Numbers 34 say that this is the area of the land of Israel, inside the red line. Now, this is a rabbi here. His writing is Kaftor Vaferach. He is a minimalist. He feels the land of Israel looks like that in the kingdom. Another rabbi, Tavuas Haaretz, he's another minimalist. He feels the land looks something like that in the kingdom. All right? There's a third view. I call it the maximalist view. And this view has a heavy dependence on imagination. Okay? Let's show you how this view is developed. The people who hold to this view usually run a line down the Nile, like that. They go as far as they can to the west. Then they run a line across the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, and that is a key line in their view. So note that, running across the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, over to the Euphrates, then up the Euphrates, and over to the Mediterranean Sea, and voila! Greater Israel, there it is, okay? Now there's a lot of variation here. This is one, there's another. They run the line down where the Suez Canal is. They kind of ignore the rest of the boundaries, there's another. Here's another, at least they follow boundary here on the where the Suez Canal is. At least they follow the Euphrates. That's another one, little variation. There's another one. These people don't even follow the Euphrates. They go up the border between Iran and Iraq and across the border between Iraq and Syria and Turkey, and that's greater Israel to them. Now, a dispensational conservative commentator, Reverend Clarence Larkin, does a similar thing, although he at least tries to follow the biblical information. He starts here at the Wadi al-Arish in the Mediterranean Sea. He draws his line over here to where it bumps into the Euphrates, up the Euphrates to where he believes Hamat is, and that's the territory. All right. What I will do next week, we will go through the material in verses 15 through 17, we'll take a look at all the biblical material on the land. And then when we get through that material on page 696, then I will give you my opinion, okay? You got three opinions here, but you got a Jewish teacher, so four opinions, okay? I will give you my opinion next week. I come at this from a different perspective than any of these views. So you can decide whether it's a valid perspective or not. All righty, I've kept you 5 minutes over. Oy vey. Let me pray, and then we'll turn you loose. Father, again, thank you for your word. And again, thank you for the wonders of the Messianic kingdom that we are going to experience in the future when the kingdom is instituted. All this this miraculous water, these miraculous trees, the productivity of the whole earth, we look forward to that, Lord. But while we wait, help us to remember that principle, burn it into our minds, that the pleasures of sin only last for a season, and they will cost us an eternity of blessing. And so when temptation from the world rears its ugly head and bumps into our path, help us to remember what happened to Reuben. He lost an eternity of blessing for 30 minutes, for an hour of pleasure. And Lord, help us turn away from the temptations of this world and focus our eyes on the future, on the Messianic kingdom, and the glorious hope you lay before us when Yeshua returns. We need your help to do that. We need to learn to resist the devil. And we need your help to do that as well. So we lift ourselves up to you as your weak children, grateful that your Spirit lives within us and that you indeed will not test us beyond what we're able to bear. So we thank you in Yeshua's name. Amen.